especially from Halb 7 Records, the new Psychobilly magazine. Psychomania has been released, so look for that. It's a mail order only, pretty much, because it's released in German over across the pond and not necessarily on the newsstands in America. But it is the Bible to all things psychobilly if you're interested. Got to take a break for some messages and turn everything over to the Monday Talk Forum now. So tune in next week for more rockabilly and psychobilly sounds here on The Wrecking Hour.
Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Are you looking for a real degree that's going to prepare you for the future? Then listen up. The Alternative Energy Technology degree is great for students looking to prepare themselves for a career in a new generation of green jobs. Students will learn about renewable energy and promoting and practicing of energy efficiency. If you're interested in more information about this degree or any of the other degrees here at HFCC, please call 1-800-585-HFCC or visit them online at www.hfcc.edu.
Join me, LaBeth, here at WHFR.FM. Together, we will enjoy a montage of music featuring various jazz styles. Old jazz, blues in jazz, and jazz just as you like it. Listen every Wednesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. here at 89.3 in Dearborn, the station making jazz waves like no other.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Hey, this is Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. You know all those public radio fundraisers? They raise millions of dollars. You know what they do with the money? We stole some of it, and we bribed Marketplace, the big American public media show, to let us do our Freakonomics segment on there. Here you go.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Ty Rizdahl.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, Kai, thanks. I've got a little Thanksgiving quiz for you. You up for that?
No, I don't do quizzes. It's my show. All right, what?
I'm going to force you today. All right, here we go. Americans will probably eat about 40 million turkeys this month. Now, I hope this doesn't kill your appetite, but what percentage of those 40 million birds do you think were the product of artificial insemination?
Really? That's the question.
That's the question. It is really the question.
Wow. Okay. 82.6. I don't know.
It's a great, great guess. Great guess. The truth is, it's actually pretty close to 100%.
Really? So there's no like turkey sex going on?
Well, let's unravel this.
All right.
Let me ask you this, Kai. When you roast your family turkey, what ends up being the most popular meat that everybody wants?
Always the white meat. It's the breast meat.
Always the white meat. My family, the same. Some people would say that's just because you want to increase the surface area for gravy. But whatever the case, Americans love their white meat. And this goes back to the 1950s when traditional turkeys got pushed out by a breed called the broad-breasted white, which grows bigger and faster than the traditional bird. And that broad-breasted white has been selectively bred to have the largest breasts possible. There's just one problem with this, and I'm going to let Julie Long from the USDA explain it to you.
The modern turkey has a quite large turkey breast, and it actually physically gets in the way when the male and the female try to create offspring.
Create offspring. Come on, really? Did she just say that?
She just said that.
It gets in the way.
On your air.
I know, right? They can't, and my mother's listening too. They can't, you know, do it.
That's exactly. It's tragic, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you think about it. And as a result, the turkey industry is built around artificial insemination, which is a very labor-intensive and hands-on process. Here's the way it works. A team of workers has to pick up each male breeder, the tom, which might weigh as much as 70 pounds, secure his contribution, as they call it in the trade, and then bring that to the hen house to inseminate each hen. And then keep in mind, with such intense consumer demand for turkey, this is not a once-a-year event. Here's Julie Long again from the USDA.
So that means once a week for 5 to 6 months, you have to
wow.
go work with the males and then go work with the females in order to produce the meat that goes out for the consumer.
Okay, so a couple of things. I love this in its entirety. One, who knew that girl turkeys were called hens?
True.
Two, I love the way she said work with. You have to work with them. But three, this is also conceivably, just to get back to the business thing here, it's a jobs program. You need people to go work with these turkeys.
That is a bright side, absolutely a silver lining. Now, keep in mind, if you don't like this idea and you want to serve your family a turkey this Thanksgiving that's the product of, you know, natural old-fashioned turkey reproduction, then you might turn to what's called a heritage turkey. Here's Cindy Muller, who raises heritage birds in Illinois. But keep in mind, as she makes clear, Kai, it'll cost you.
I know in some parts of the country, the price of a heritage bird for your Thanksgiving table can be over $150, $200 for a bird.
No way.
Way.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot, well over triple, let's say, what you'd pay for a big bird. Yeah.
Just to let a turkey have a little fun in life, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, look, the holidays are supposed to be a feel-good time. So you
stop,
may decide stop, that instead stop. Of making yourself feel good by dropping, let's say, $100 in the Salvation Army bucket, you might want to spend that $100 subsidizing the right of some male turkey to, well, you know,
And females, it should
holiday.
Be said.
There you go.
And females. Freakonomics.com is the website. That's where you send all the hate mail this week. Stephen Dubner, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, Kai. Happy eating.
I don't know about that.
I'm Brian Dunning from Skeptoid.com. You're listening to
Monster Talk.
Oh, man, did you see that? Classic bait and switch. Terrible, right? Well, I don't want to be accused of misrepresenting what we are here. This is a podcast about monsters, and I have to be honest, there is almost no content in this episode that has to do with monsters. But it is probably the funniest interview we've ever done on the show. So I'd say listen to it, but forewarned is forearmed, especially if you're a Girilon from D&D. Oh, look at that. I just increased the monster content by about 100%. Get ready for a very silly interview with Dr. Richard Wiseman.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Sometimes when you do an interview, things don't go as you expect. While we were at TAM 9, the James Randi Educational Foundation's aptly named Amazing Meeting, we had a great opportunity to interview a number of notable skeptics, scientists, researchers, yet mostly we didn't. That's because the format of Monster Talk is one where we try to focus on monsters and or monster-related topics. Yes, of course, we usually weight our discussions towards science rather than legend, but there's many fascinating topics that we'll probably never dedicate an episode of Monster Talk to simply because they're not related to monsters. I'll give you a few examples. Near-death experience, psychics, alternative medicine, and conspiracy theories, just to name a few. I find them interesting topics, but they really have nothing to do with monsters. Dr. Richard Wiseman is a British psychologist, and he studied a lot of these phenomena. But more importantly, he studied why people believe in them. And that's the topic of his latest book, Paranormality, Why We See What Isn't There. On his website, richardwiseman.com, he has a blog which he frequently fills with stories of ghosts and optical illusions. It's topics I enjoy. When he agreed to talk with us for this interview, I vaguely thought we'd be talking a lot about ghosts. However, as I mentioned before, sometimes interviews don't go the way one expects. This interview was a very, very silly thing. And I was pondering what to do with it because it's really quite unlike a typical interview that we would do. But in addition to his interest in these paranormal topics, Wiseman has something else in common with our show. He is reviled by the host of the podcast Skeptico, Alex Sakiris. This is a trait he shares with my co-host, Ben Radford. Both Wiseman and Radford have been on the show Skeptico and have then been berated in absentia by the show's host. If you're not familiar with the show, don't be misled by its title. That is Skeptico with a K, and the show is about as skeptical as an episode of In Search of or Finding Bigfoot. Wiseman's run-in with Skeptico happened because of his work investigating the allegedly psychic dog, JT, which is a matter he covers in the initial part of his book. Radford's run-in with Alex had to do with an investigation into psychic detectives. In both cases, Alex was deeply dissatisfied with the outcomes of those interviews. There was a terrible communication failure, and it revolved around the issues of bias and understanding the basics of science as a methodology and the difference in the worldviews of Alex compared to Wiseman and Radford. Recently, Alex reached out to Karen Stolzno and interviewed her, but much of the interview was him badgering her about Radford again. He wanted to rehash Radford's psychic detective case and what he has characterized as lying and intellectual dishonesty. Radford, on the other hand, has maintained that Alex didn't understand his position, which might be best summarized in a few observations such as psychic detectives tend to make vague claims that are later remembered as very specific, and memory is very fallible and malleable. Ben actually devoted an entire chapter of his recent book, Scientific Paranormal Investigation, to this case. Now, why am I mentioning all this? Because I did not want to leave Alex's taunts and insults unanswered, and despite our differences, Alex and I are both interested in many of the same topics, as are Ben and Karen. And I found his approach to be both disheartening and annoying. I think his claims need to be addressed, and if he wants to have a debate with the hosts of Monster Talk, which he does, well, we're not going to walk away from it. I have to warn you, there's virtually no way this debate will be topical to monsters. But if you're interested in hearing the outcome, we've partnered with our sister podcast, Skepticality, and Derek and Swoopy are going to host the debate in the Skepticality episode feed. I believe it will show up as a regular episode in their feed, perhaps with a short explanatory introduction by them. We'll be recording it on November 10th, barring unforeseen circumstances, and I assume it will be up the following Wednesday. We will try to keep it civil. I really do think that's the best approach. But I would advise taking a drink every time you hear a logical fallacy, or you're likely to end up in the hospital. That being said, let's get on to this very unusual interview with a very funny fellow, psychologist Dr. Richard Wiseman.
Monster Talk.
We're here today talking with Dr. Richard Wiseman.
Hello.
Who, and we're at, there's a helium leak.
Hello. Yes, I'm going to put on a silly voice for the whole of this. Not this one. This is my actual voice, but I'll be putting on a silly one for
any
answer.
I'd like to answer that question in two ways. First, my normal voice. So, you have a new book out?
I have. Paranormality. Oh, it's good.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. It's a work of genius. That's what it says on the back cover.
I haven't read it yet, but I've downloaded it to my Kindle. So my Kindle has actually just been enriched by the process.
Absolutely.
So, I downloaded it illegally, so we're good.
Did you really download it illegally? That is a disgraceful thing to do.
It would also be a shocking improvement in your technical skill.
I'm shocked. I'm very anti people downloading things illegally. Well, not actually. I'm anti them downloading my material illegally when they should be paying me for it.
I was actually joking. I haven't downloaded it.
Really?
As Blake mentioned, that would be a shocking leap forward in my technical
ability. It would really be.
Good.
It's out of character and out of skill set. So.
They can't see this on the mic, can they?
I have an actual question.
Oh.
Okay, good.
Lordy. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
here we go. I did an interview with Richard recently for Point of Inquiry.
I've not heard that show.
Oh, it's put together by a little organization called CFI.
What's the URL? I'll have to look it up.
PointofInquiry.org.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
And so one of the questions I didn't ask you was about JT the psychic dog.
Oh, not JT the psychic dog. Yeah, it's like haunts me.
It's a show about monsters and
animals.
Oh, and we have an intimate relationship with Skeptico, so this should be good.
Right, yes. He loves me.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I've
got
that, yes.
Oh, he loves me. He comes over, he gives me a little hug, a little kiss. He loathes me. JT, the psychic dog, is a terrier, I believe, is the breed of dog. And I did this TV show years and years and years ago. And Austrian television had worked out this dog was psychic by taking their owner away. And then when the owner was coming back, the dog went to the window, and this was seen as evidence of the terrier's amazing abilities. And I said, I stepped forward on the show. I said, no, I'm not having this. I said, that dog may well be going to the window a lot. And so we went on and did our own investigation into the dog, and indeed he was going to the window a lot. So we wrote up a paper saying this dog isn't psychic, he just goes to the window a lot. And then Rupert Sheldrake, a parapsychologist, was very upset with us, and he did his own work and thought the dog was psychic. And ever since, the two of us have been arguing about the psychic dog, as if two grown men should have nothing better to do with their time. And if you have trouble sleeping, that material is on the web. You can read it all. Yeah. Yeah. The dog is dead now, I believe. So
the data set is finished.
That's right. unless, of course.
Sylvia Brown can take care of it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it could be the spirit of the dog, or another dog could channel JT.
Right. Well, that really is a totally separate data.
I think my cat is channeling JT because sometimes she's at the window. Sometimes she's, other times she's not.
Cats are random, they don't have any predictability.
That's true.
But go on.
I hate cats. I really hate cats. I love dogs, but I hate cats. I loathe cats.
See, now with that phrase that you just put in there, I can replace cats with Richard Sheldrake.
Rupert Sheldrake, yes.
Rupert, sorry.
I like Rupert, actually.
He sounds like Rupert.
He's a very nice man. Yeah. But no, I hate... It's because they're very sort of independent-minded, unlike a dog, which is just stupid. If all the cats disappeared in the world, it seems to me there'd be no loss to humanity at all.
It's a harsh thing to say.
But
what would the old ladies hoard? They'd have to find something completely different.
We could find something. Wolves. Wolves. They could hoard wolves. I'd be very pro that. But
one of God's creatures.
I tell you how I assess animals. Would you be prepared? Let's imagine an animal could handle a handgun, right? You'd give it to a dog, wouldn't you? Because they wouldn't kill you. The most they'd do is bury it in the garden. Exactly. Well, the worst they do is blow their head. Yes. Give that to a cat, you wouldn't trust it. You would not trust a cat with a handgun. All your credit card details would be gone, everything would be gone, and they'd be off. I can't help feeling we've wandered away from the point.
My children want a pet, so I have my children, they're all lobbying for pets.
Yeah.
And the conversation I've had goes something like this. The dogs can be loyal companions. Cats are little killers that you take care of.
Yeah. So they are killing machines. All the research shows that dogs are really good for your health, for everything. There's a new book come out, 100 Experiments, that show why dogs are good for you. Not one little cat, nothing. Nothing. Hate
I sense
that.
Selection bias.
Yeah,
on my part, yes. Well, also the book's called 100 Experiments Why Dogs Are Good For You.
There's no cats in the index.
No. Hate them.
So you were talking about JT.
Yeah, JT. Yes. It's a dog. So I quite liked it. Very cute dog, actually.
Right. Was.
Well, it was.
Yes.
Yeah.
A former dog.
Former dog. So anyway, so since then, since writing what I thought was just like a silly paper for British Journal of Psychology, or the only psychic dog paper in 100 years of the BJP's publication.
You must be very proud.
Oh, so proud. This thing
They've been hounding him ever since.
Hey! So since then, yes, it's sort of haunted me. It keeps on coming back. People keep on going on about the psychic dog thing, on and on and on.
So how do they see JT is important?
Rupert, I think, has plotted. He's done some plot. He did two sorts of experiments. One where he had random homecomings and one where he didn't. And he sort of mixed up the data, in my opinion, and falsely concluded the dog's psychic. But he gets very upset when you have a go at JT. But it's all online. It's all very complicated.
It is. And that because Alex's take on it is, I believe, that your data matched Sheldrake's data.
Well, we've only got four trials. And it is true that I think the pattern three of them is the same as Rupert's. But it's not about the patterning. It's about the interpretation.
Exactly.
I think there's nothing surprising in the fact that patterning is there. So it's kind of interesting from a sort of methodological point of view. Because obviously you can't ask the dog. Or you could ask it. That wouldn't be surprising. But if it replied, that would be more surprising. So the interesting thing with all animal work is how you try and work out what's going on in an animal's head.
Right, but do the patterns match? That's an easy question.
Oh, the patterns probably
do. The interpretation is more subtle.
That's right.
And I think that's a pretty serious issue in that sort of interface between skeptics and believers. How do you interpret the data?
But does anyone really care? They should.
No, I would say I don't care. But you don't care.
Really, none of us care.
None of us care.
But we've been spending 10 minutes on it. So yeah. Story.
Specifically about JT, but there's this whole other issue of whether or not psychic powers are real, and what's happened is skepticism has relegated these sort of studies into this really small niche, and is that niche kingdom is coveted. And at the same time, it's reviled by skeptics, and everybody who's in it is fighting to get it out and make it powerful, you know. And that's sort of, I think I've stretched that metaphor as far as I can. But I guess the point is, to people who aren't defending that position, it seems trivial. And to people who are, it's paramount. So
it is. I mean, and parapsychology is a long history of this debate with skeptics going backwards and forwards. I just think this particular one with this particular dog, I think I'll just move on. Go and get another psychic dog. And we'll do it all again.
Or fetch me another.
Yeah, fetch me. That's right.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
And has he been doing that? I mean, is he open to doing it again?
There was one other dog, but the experiments are quite straightforward to do. It's just that the way Rupert does them, I think, have got a big flaw right in the middle of them. So I'm actually quite pro a lot of Rupert's work. I think it's quite clever, but there's always these methodological problems with it. Well, I think what's interesting is they're pretty straightforward experiments to do, and for some reason they're never done in this kind of watertight way.
But you have to admit that he does have one of the leading psychic dog protocols.
I see. That's clever. That's clever. Yeah, there's a whole pack of them.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, moving on. Let's move on from JT.
Move on away from JT. Well, I hate to, because we do need to talk to Alex in the near future, so... But I guess we will. So you have this book we were saying.
Oh, it's good.
What's it about?
Work of genius. It's called Paranormality. And it's about, it starts off the premises that paranormal phenomena are not genuine. And so we don't get bogged down too much in the sort of like, oh, is it true? No, it's not true. Yes, it is true. No, really not true. And then you go back. It starts off with the idea, maybe they're not genuine. And then ask the question, why do people believe in psychics or mediums or have out of body experiences? What do these things tell us about our brains and our beliefs and our behavior? And I don't want to use the phrase work of genius.
Too many times.
That's right. That's the end of that sentence. So I did it, and it's coming out in about 20 different languages, but not in America. Not in America.
So here's a story.
Yeah.
Breaking here now.
Yeah.
Is there a conspiracy to keep you out of American bookstores?
Yes. Yes. It's the assassination of presidents is linked somehow with the Twin Towers disaster and Paranormality not being published.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's clear to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I see you've drawn some lines here. That's very compelling.
I know.
Yeah.
And JT as well. It's all linked together in one big conspiracy.
If you just look at it the right way.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what can people...
Is JT behind the grassy knoll?
So here's the question.
Urinating on it.
Maybe this is not the right question to ask, but in addition to hosting this podcast, I'm also very interested in digital publishing and how it's changing the publishing industry.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So is your digital book put out by your British publisher?
No. So to get into the mechanics of it, you'd sell the right to reach territory. So you'd sell in the UK, and by some quirk of history, they also own Canada and Australia. But then you sell every other territory. So you would sell in Germany, you'd sell in France and so on. And then you'd sell it in the US. So as an author, without it being sold, I own the rights to the US.
Ah.
So that's just the way it goes. And so in this particular instance, I can put out a Kindle very easily because of digital technology, which is just a complete amazing platform. The physical book is harder because it's thicker. It's thicker. Yeah. When you hit people with it, it hurts more. And so it's harder because you have to actually physically produce this thing and distribute it, which is very hard to do. So I've asked my UK publisher, Macmillan, to do that in the US.
Oh, really?
So they're shipping over copies, but they are the British copies, and they're also very scarce.
So how do you use the word color or airplane? Because that could be really confusing the way it's spelled.
Yes, all of that. It is very confusing for people.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a little chart you get with the color.
Like an insert.
That's right. That's right.
Nice. Yeah.
And do you have typos sprinkled throughout?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
But if we could skip that whole process and save the expensive boat trips, if we just buy the Kindle edition.
Absolutely. I'd be very pro you doing that.
I imagine you would.
Yes.
From what I know of the Kindle.
Yes.
Yeah, because of the environment, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially
the main reason.
Around your bank account and wallet.
Yes. Well, it is changing, because the publishers are very, very nervous at the minute because, it means that you get 70% of the cover price as an author versus...
Well, many of our listeners are capitalists and would agree with this.
Yeah.
Because not only do you get more money, but we save money.
You do.
Yeah, so it's really good.
So it's a very interesting time. And of course, bookstores are going under. Borders, I think, has gone. Waterstones, I think. It's a very interesting time.
Yeah, it's very sad to see the empty borders. So
It is sad, but it is, I believe, driven in part by the Kindle success.
Was part of the reluctance that for US publishers that a skeptical book was not going to be well received and well sold? They just heard about you and they're like, we're not
publishing him. Yeah,
Christ.
Yeah. I went to one of the meetings and there's a big picture of JT on the wall. I thought this is going to go badly. I said, just leave it. It doesn't matter. It's a rough time for publishing. I mean, to be fair, we're in a sort of economic downturn and Kindle is changing everything. So it is a difficult time for them. And I suspect they're moving over to sure bets. And I think they looked at this and said, the paranormal books that sell very well are the ones that are saying it's all true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not science-y enough to be a hardcore science book. It's not about physics or chemistry or whatever. And I think they're just very, very nervous about it. And there was this suggestion that if I could rewrite it to suggest that maybe some ghost did exist, or some psychics were genuine, then maybe there was an audience. And I was saying that was quite a rewrite. It wasn't just dropping the word not out. Is it
possible that because you spelled skeptic with a C, they thought the book was about septic?
Oh, now you said that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and apologize to a lot of people.
Clearly.
I'm so sorry. There's been a huge misunderstanding.
Associating us with sewage, yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Not for the first time in my experience, but it's as an author, the notion of putting out a book and being able to distribute it on Kindle, 5 years ago, I think that would have been impossible. You're seeing this change so quickly.
And there weren't Kindles.
That would have been why it would have been tricky.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been actual wood.
It would have been a Sony e-reader, and it's a totally different experience.
Yeah, I love the Kindle. I've got to say, I bought one a couple of weeks ago, and it's so good. I was reading on the plane on the way over, and it feels like paper.
I don't want people to think, they talk about big pharma. I don't want people to think we're part of big Amazon, but I really do love my Kindle. And the fact that I get the Kindle app for my phone and the Kindle app for my iPod, iPad.
There are other applications out there, but yes, it is great.
Yeah, very nice.
If we could just go to a more general topic. Do I need to move in?
I've got you on the sort of audio B over here.
Oh, okay, because I thought a lot. I was trying to project more into that one.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Sure. So you've written a lot about psychics and ghosts over the years, and I'm wondering if you've ever treated cryptozoology in any of your works.
I don't think I have. I don't think I've ever gone near Bigfoot.
Psychic Bigfoot.
Psychic Bigfoot. You know, there are two areas I think I haven't touched on. One is UFOs, and the other is cryptozoology. So I don't think I have anything to add to this other than an enormous amount of ignorance. It won't stop me talking about it. I mean, yeah. I could talk endlessly.
Well, ghosts, because of the
I've got a gorilla suit, if that makes any difference.
No. Might here in Vegas, but I don't know if it does in general. Did you bring it?
I always travel with it.
Excellent.
It gets a bit cold on the aircraft sometimes.
So,
sure.
And if you need to hide from believers. Oh, I thought that was Richard Wiseman, the JT hater, but it's just some gorilla.
Never mind. Carry on.
I think Wiseman's still in that restroom over there. I saw him go in. I'm going to cut that out. You do deal with ghosts, though,
yeah.
Extensively. So here's a question for our listeners, or a topic to discuss. Much ado has been made about ultra-low frequencies and EMF, and how those things can have an impact on the brain and its perception of possible hauntings. Has any direct correlation been made between those audible frequencies or electromagnetics and reproducible sort of things?
Oh, I think it's a really controversial area. So there's a couple of different...
Nice.
that was just psychologist talk for bollocks. So basically you have two different areas. One into the infrasound, the low-frequency sound waves. And I think that's plausible. I think it's plausible. And the late Vic Tandy came up with this idea that low-frequency sound waves could make you feel slightly weird. And then we did the experiment where we staged two concerts and put the infrasound into one of them, and people did have more weird experiences. So I think that's at least plausible. But we'd made the machine which pumps this stuff in. The idea of that being naturally occurring, to me, is a little bit far-fetched, but maybe. And then there's the EMF stuff, and particularly Persinger's sort of God helmet idea. And I'm pretty sceptical about that. I mean, now there's been some studies where you can get the same effects without turning on the helmet. I suspect what you're looking at is suggestibility a lot of the time on it. So I'm not a big fan of that.
Do these experiments help support a materialistic view of ghost experiences? And I think what you're saying is no.
I think that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
I think that the infrasound may be EMF. I mean, they're really small, weak signals, and our heads are pretty well insulated against it. So I think it would take a bit of convincing for me to think there's something going on there.
Wow. So do you think that you see any methodological flaws with Persinger's? I want to work through this in post a lot. Is it Persinger or Persinger?
I think either will be fine, depending where you're from.
Okay. Yeah. Did you see any methodological flaws with the experiments, or do you think that other studies afterwards, is what you're saying, other studies afterwards have shown that it may be placebo?
Yeah. I mean, so basically somebody took the equipment, didn't turn on the current,
nice.
And then you get the same effects. He's argued against that. But that should be your control condition.
Yes, it should. So what was it before?
I'm not certain. It's unclear to me what the control condition.
Okay. Wow.
Do you think he's heard of control conditions, or he thought that they weren't relevant to his research?
I think you see, you could see how you could get into this trap of thinking, well, you put the helmet on, and people have these weird experiences. Of course, they wouldn't have that without the helmet. And so, it turns out it is. But somebody else, a historian, pointed out to me, when you look at the really old Victorian sort of phrenology, hypnosis literature, that you've got hypnotists pointing at areas in the head and then people having really weird experiences which apparently correspond to that particular area. And he said it's not unlike the Persinger stuff, where you know, if you get suggestible people and you say, yep, this is now stimulating your whatever zone, that they have the experience. So it could be that going on. So I'm quite skeptical about it.
What about, okay, so Persinger's God helmet?
Yeah.
You're skeptical. What about his wizard shoes?
The wizard shoes are genuine.
Nice.
The wizard shoes, the ones that make you fly, they're genuine. Yes. Yeah, I've actually got a pair of them upstairs.
So what about people having experiences in rooms with oddly shaped ceilings?
I suspect what's going on is we've got stereotypes in our heads of what sorts of rooms are haunted from films and so on. I'm going to cough. So I think we have stereotypes in our heads in terms of what sort of rooms are haunted, And when you walk into them, you feel scared. If you're a suggestible person, you then get all the stuff kind of following on from that. I suspect that's what's
so
happening.
You could test that by taking people with different cultural backgrounds and exposing them to spooky houses and seeing if they're affected.
Yeah, or you tell people one room's haunted, another one's not, and right. Then you switch it around, and lo and behold, they have all the experiences in the room which is allegedly haunted.
You ever have sleep paralysis yourself?
No, sleep terror I have. I have a lot of sleep terror.
So I have a relative who has that, which right. Sucks. So I've had sleep paralysis. Very scary.
Yeah.
So
yeah. No, it's
do you sleep terror more problem for other people near you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big time. So people don't sleep terror. You wake up. You don't wake up. That's the problem. You sit up, and then you're convinced there's a demonic entity. Normally, yeah. In my case, or a terrible dog. Never a cat. Interesting enough. Terrible dog in the room.
Psychic dog.
So you can scream out. You can so my partner Caroline then wakes up thinking there's somebody in the house or something, and so her adrenaline's going, her heart's going, just to see me kind of just fall gently back to sleep, and I'm fine, and now she's terrified. So, yeah, that's great. It's pretty much a nightly occurrence. It's
wow.
Hilarious, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I fake quite a lot of them because it's just quite funny then to watch her.
It's a lot more fun if you
oh, it's
yeah,
hilarious.
For sure.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did you Paranormal Activity, the movie, did you see
yeah,
that?
Yeah, love that. I thought yeah. It was good. So I enjoyed it.
Now, you probably have been filming yourself for some time, right?
There was a time when we were doing the ghost work when we had infrared cameras and movement sensors, and because of the night terror, I set them up and
yeah,
filmed myself.
I would too.
And
yeah.
They're great.
Yeah.
They're great to watch because you're up and because you're looking around, you're following this demonic entity, you go straight back to sleep, and because I never get to see it.
Yeah.
So, no, it's kind of fun. Yeah. In fact, then some sleep researchers have used that tape because it's quite rare to have people tape themselves doing it.
Wow.
No, 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 you don't remember at all. No. Unless you drift out of consciousness. If you say the person's name quietly, they slowly drift out, but then you feel a complete idiot because you're telling somebody about the dogs, and then you suddenly realize that you're actually in your own house and there are no dogs, and then you try and justify it. But it's, there's no dogs, don't be daft. And then you go back to sleep thinking, I now feel a complete tit.
Yeah, the relative I have, you wake them, this is completely pointless to wake them up and talk to them about it. It's just. As he said, you wake up horrified that someone dying, someone screaming,
yeah.
You know, and it's really, really frightening for the non-participants, right?
Yeah. So the scariest experience I ever had, I was in a hotel, this was probably about 7 or 8 years ago, and in the morning, I woke up and I thought, God, I had a dream. It was a dream. I remember it coming back to me. It was like some zombies or somebody trying to get into the room. God, it's a weird dream. And I turned around and the chair was jammed really hard against the door
wow.
In the hotel room, really seriously hard. So I'd obviously got out of bed, jammed this chair really hard, gone back to bed and slept.
That's a good self-defense system you have there.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it's good. Yeah, because so. It's possibly worth genuine
so
zombies.
So your partner probably doesn't let you have weapons around the bed.
Well, she likes that, you see, because it adds a certain frisson. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Nice. Me have weapons around? Do you know in my hometown you have to have a loaded handgun?
That's what they do there, right?
No, I mean it's an ordinance. You have to own a loaded handgun. So
do you?
Well,
yeah.
So
it's.
I was just going to ask about.
Look it up, Kennesaw, Georgia.
Is that what they do? Is that what they do?
It's a friendly town, but don't try to commit a crime.
I'll shoot your ass. Well, given that you've been doing this for decades now, the sorts of research, and you've become something of a celebrity in the UK and elsewhere, and you and your work spans everything from luck to ghosts to this and that, you have a very broad set of data that you've developed and this and that. I'm wondering what's been the response among the British public. Are there certain of your projects that really resonate that people are like, oh my God, this is awesome? And are there other projects that are just generally ignored because they think that it's irrelevant or what?
Before he answers that question, I'm going to tell our listeners that Mr. Wiseman, or Dr. Wiseman, is actually
professor
has actually changed his clothes, and Ben Radford is now wearing a fake mustache.
Mm.
Completely surprised me.
That's the sense of integrity I bring to even podcasts. You can't see it, but all of us are naked.
I was shocked.
Naked.
I didn't notice it until I pointed it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
In terms of the public, I don't think they're particularly interested in the paranormal. So what I'm best known for is my work into psychology of luck and some of the 59 seconds work into self-help. Most recently... and this got the same amount of flack as the paranormal, was the wine tasting experiment I did where we gave people expensive and inexpensive wine and they couldn't tell the difference. 50-50 on every single type of wine we tried.
Wow.
Boy, already did the opposite of the wine industry.
But that's been done before.
I know. Yeah. They hate it. They hate
it's
that.
Done by someone from Britain.
And it was done in a high profile way. We did it as part of the Edinburgh Science Festival, so it's the front page of a lot of newspapers. Whoa, that was a bit like saying ghosts don't exist. It was like this flood of emails coming in. So that was quite exciting.
And did they question your methodology?
Yeah, they didn't understand it. They couldn't. My favourite one was that somebody said, right, so you gave them either inexpensive or expensive wine, said, could you tell the difference? And they're at 50-50. I said, yep. And they said, that means they were right half the time. That's a very interesting interpretation of that data set. So they got very upset, and they demanded to know which wines and all sorts of things. Yeah, they got very nasty about it. But as you say, it's been done time and again.
That's interesting. So you actually set the some of the best bottled versus the best boxed wines.
Yeah, we had pretty much. We had wine that was terrible. It was about £2.50, which is
Is that money?
No, that's
actually
weighed £2. £2. That's right. Yes. I don't want £2.50. It's $4 or something versus £20. So quite an expensive bottle of wine.
And heavier.
Even heavier. And people could not tell the difference, which is quite funny.
Nice.
Even wine tasters couldn't.
And, if you drink another, you don't care anyway. That's
precisely. At the end of the experiment, I have to guess who they were.
That's a dating tip out there, guys.
Cut.
This is fun. This is one of the better interviews we've had.
That's terrifying.
Despite Richard being here.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you just cut me out. It's just you guys chatting. I'm trying to think of who I did have dinner with the other day. No, it's because I'm jet lagged.
I
didn't have dinner with him, then that's a much longer list. Charles, who does the eyewitness testimony stuff into sea monsters.
Dr. Charles Paxton.
Yes.
Anyway.
So he's doing a whole thing on sea monsters, loads and loads of stuff about observation and sea monsters.
Excellent.
Yeah. But we shouldn't talk about it because it's all secret. I'll talk about it off mic. Yeah. But he's really getting in contact with it.
Sea monsters.
But he's doing a whole load of things where he's dressing people up as Bigfoot and getting them to walk around
in the ocean.
Places. In the ocean. Yeah. Yeah.
That will shock some people.
Yeah. So he's a good guy. He's really good. Yeah. He's a very interesting job. His job is working out how you tell the population of things like dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
So from observations...
Because they hate surveys.
They hate surveys. You try and think, and they go, no, we're too busy.
Right, yeah. No, seriously, is this a conspiracy? Because I'm not into this. So.
It's a very interesting job. He does for the UN. He does try to work out how many dolphins are on the world.
It is a part of a conspiracy. I was joking, and it's no really.
There you go.
Yeah. It's just interesting.
He does it for the UN.
Yeah, because it really matters. To work out whether dolphin populations are going up or down...
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how can you do it? Because you can't count them.
Oh, so they've said you can't do that because that would give you the real answer.
Which they're just hard to get a hold of.
No, you can't count them.
You're forbidden to count them, but I want to know how many there are.
That's right. And no counting. One, two. No, I told you, no counting. So it's very interesting mathematical modelling. And then he went from that. So what it's all about is how you take... People saying, I saw a dolphin last week. And you take all of those things and you get an idea of the population. But then he noticed that you could do the same with sea monster sightings. And so that's what he's about.
Which are also not supposed to be counted or immune to counting. There's a punchline there. I'll work it out. So.
Yeah.
So about this new book?
Yes. Work a genius.
Yes.
So very good.
If a person was going to buy your book.
Yeah, or download
or
it.
Or download
Kindle.
It.
Yes, legal.
What would they find?
They would find me being slightly financially better off and considerably happier.
Nice.
So
is that all it takes?
Is there a correlation?
Sad, sad man.
Is it a causal relationship or just a strong correlation?
Very strong correlation.
Very strong correlation.
Yeah.
Nice.
You can never tell those different which direction it goes in. They'll find a sort of sceptical primer because I was thinking, I don't think it's a single book that puts it all together and says, here's our current thinking on all these different types of experiences. And hopefully they'd have a good time.
Now, will
you be going on Skeptico to talk about it?
I just did Coast to Coast.
That's different. Oh. How did George handle it?
He was nice. He's perfectly pleasant.
He seems like a gentleman. And then you get your stuff in front of 3 million people.
Yeah.
So that's nice. Many of whom can read. It's fantastic.
Some. But some of the phone things in were... just that awful type of, you know, I've had this experience which there is no possible explanation. Now, you explain that. There was a lot of that going on with the people calling in. You know, I saw a ghost, it was sitting there, I've ruled out every single possible explanation. I've got it on film, there are 100 witnesses, it cannot be explained. Now, you explain that.
It's like the counting thing, right?
Right, yes, exactly. So, yeah.
Don't count on it.
Wow. Are we done?
I'm afraid we probably are, but I have a question.
Yeah.
So you you did an American special on comedy with
Lewis Black. That was lovely.
So what was that like?
It
was lovely.
A funny man.
You sort of answered my question before I asked it. Are you psychic?
Yes. He's a lovely man. He's very funny.
Yeah.
He's very funny. And so this was to do the world's funniest joke, and we tried. It was an interesting day because we had a schoolroom set up, and the idea was that I was telling him about my search for the world's funniest joke, and we tried it one way and it didn't work. We tried it a second way, so we tried it as him, a school pupil, it didn't work. Tried it with him interrupting me, it didn't work, and then we finally kind of nailed it in the final thing.
But with him as straight man, contending you failed.
That's right, that's right. And then that worked, and you could feel it coming alive. But it was a little bit, it was getting close, because that was the final take on it. And we only had about another sort of 15 minutes or so.
Good.
But it is funny, on YouTube. He's a very funny man.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah.
And very skeptical.
It was funny too, it was good.
I'm hilarious, but he's quite a strong atheist as well, isn't he, Lewis Black?
I believe so.
Yeah.
If he's not, he's probably in trouble with his God. So
right.
He said some very rude things.
Right. That's right. Yes. He's good. He made me giggle.
Nice. That's good.
Well, I just want one other question for me, which is that, again, given all the different things you've looked into, luck, ghost, everything else, wine tasting, what are you most proud of in terms of something that you really feel is your enduring contribution?
Not JT. Definitely not JT. I think I would go with the luck work. I think when that came out, and it came out all around the world, it used to be, it's not so much now, it used to be daily emails from people saying, this has changed everything for me. And it's very hard to get those emails and not think, that's a really good use of skepticism. Mm-hmm. You take this magical thing, you unpack it, and then you repackage it in a way that suddenly people are being skeptical without realizing it and putting this stuff into their lives, and it's making a difference. So I guess that will be the thing I suspect that will be on my gravestone. It'll be Richard Luck Factor Wiseman.
It's a good book. I'm reading it and thinking of
it. Or it'll be, you know, debunker of JT. If you have anything to do with it, it'll be debunker of JT.
Right.
And there'll be a stone dog urinating constantly
right
on my grave.
In first class.
Yeah. There you go.
I would like that. That'd be a nice memorial, wouldn't it? Stone dog constantly urinating on my grave.
Just leave some of your profits from your new book so that we can finance that.
Yeah, that's fine.
I was saying, I really enjoy your website.
It's very kind, thank
your quizzes. And I don't know if you've noticed, I've done a lot of the ghost cases for the ghost photos. I do a lot of analysis. So,
oh, cool.
So
okay.
Several of them I've posted the solution. So
that's brilliant. Very, very good. Yeah, no, they're always fun when people send those in.
So I wish I lived in the UK a bit, like for the castle investigation. I would have totally driven to the castle.
That was cool to Talon. So. The windiest place on earth. We went out there. And then the ghost investigation, when we did the science of ghosts, it was amazing, about 1,000 ghost pictures we had. It was so much fun. I mean, most of them are rubbish, actually. But when you got a good one where you think, no, fair game. Yeah, that's, I can see what you mean. It's good.
The wedding photo where there's the little face.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Very creepy.
Yeah, that's
old pictures, I would assume.
No, there's some good stuff on there.
There is some really creepy stuff on there.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to Monster Talk. Today's episode was hosted by myself, Blake Smith, Ben Radford, and Dr. Karen Stolzno. We interviewed psychologist Dr. Richard Wiseman about his book, Paranormality. Or at least that's what that was supposed to be. A link to Dr. Wiseman's book is in our show notes at monstertalk.org and skeptic.com. It really is quite a thought-provoking and interesting book, despite what our silly banter may have led you to believe. Please buy a copy and help the poor man have a nice day. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily the views of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Special thanks to Brian Dunning for permission to use his audio in our intro. And speaking of thanks, I need to thank the listeners of Monster Talk for the great response to our transcript project. Your contributions have now funded 3 episodes to be transcribed. If you want to take part in this project, please go to monstertalk.org and use the donate button.
It costs less than $70 to get our episodes transcribed, so even a donation of a dollar is helpful. We really appreciate any level of support. Thanks this week to Katie Alvardo, Brian Beaton, John St. Clair, Shane Brady, James Nealon, and Robert Smith for helping this project take off. We really appreciate it. And we'll be starting some kind of producer's credit system for recognizing your contributions. Music during the intro was by the incomparable Symbian Project and used by permission. A link to the track will be in the show notes. And of course, Monster Talk theme song is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening.
Skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
We're here today talking with Dr. Richard Wiseman.
Hello.
Who? And we're at that's. There's a helium leak. So some of them still unsolved. So check that out, folks. We'll put the link in the show notes. Okay, well, thank you so much for blowing an hour with us.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
Seriously.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor. Hope you'll tune in for an hour of stories and celebratory music about the family traditions of Thanksgiving. With Geraldine Steele, Rich Dworsky, and the chorus and ensemble singers of Vocal Lessons. A Thanksgiving celebration from APM, American Public Media.
On WHFR, the station making waves. Thanksgiving Day at 4 p.m.
I started Improv Everywhere about 10 years ago when I moved to New York City with an interest in acting and comedy. Because I was new to the city, I didn't have access to a stage, so I decided to create my own in public places. So the first project we're going to take a look at is the very first No Pants subway ride. Now, this took place in January of 2002, and this woman is the star of the video. She doesn't know she's being filmed. She's being filmed with a hidden camera. This is on the 6 train in New York City, and this is the first stop along the line. These are two Danish guys who come in and sit down next to the hidden camera. And that's me right there in a brown coat. It's about 30 degrees outside. I'm wearing a hat. I'm wearing a scarf. And the girl's going to notice me right here. And as you'll see now, I'm not wearing pants. So at this point, she's noticed me, but in New York, there's weirdos in any given train car. One person's not that unusual. She goes back to reading her book, which is unfortunately titled Rape. I'm not sure. So she's noticed the unusual thing, but she's gone back to her normal life. Now, in the meantime, I have 6 friends who are waiting at the next 6 consecutive stops in their underwear as well. They're going to be entering this car one by one. We'll act as though we don't know each other. And we'll act as if it's just an unfortunate mistake we've made for getting our pants on this cold January day. So at this point, she decides to put the rape book away. She decides to be a little bit more aware of her surroundings. Now, in the meantime, the two Danish guys to the left of the camera, they're cracking up. They think this is the funniest thing they've ever seen before. And Watch her make eye contact with them right about now. And I love that moment in this video because before it became a shared experience, it was something that was maybe a little bit scary or something that was at least confusing to her. And then once it became a shared experience, it was funny and something that she could laugh at. So the train is now pulling into the third stop along the 6th line. So the video won't show everything. This goes on for another 4 stops. A total of 7 guys enter anonymously in their underwear. At the 8th stop, a girl came in with a giant duffel bag and announced she had pants for sale for $1. Like you might sell batteries or candy on the train. We all very matter-of-factly bought a pair of pants, put them on, and said, thank you, that's exactly what I needed today. And then exited without revealing what had happened and went in all different directions. So that's a still from the video there, and I love that girl's reaction so much, and watching that videotape later that day inspired me to keep doing what I do. And really the one of the points of Improv Everywhere is to cause a scene in a public place that is a positive experience for other people. It's a prank, but it's a prank that gives somebody a great story to tell. And her reaction inspired me to do a 2nd annual No Pants Subway Ride, and we continue to do it every year. This past January, we did the 10th annual No Pants Subway Ride, where a diverse group of 3,500 people rode the train in their underwear in New York, almost every single train line in the city, and also in 50 other cities around the world, people participated. As I started taking improv class at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and meeting other creative people and other performers and comedians, I started amassing a mailing list of people who wanted to do these types of projects so I could do more large-scale projects. Well, one day I was walking through Union Square and I saw this building, which had just been built in 2005. And there was a girl in one of the windows and she was dancing, and it was very peculiar because it was dark out, but she was backlit with fluorescent lighting, and she was very much on stage, and I couldn't figure out why she was doing it. After about 15 seconds, her friend appeared. She had been hiding behind a display, and they laughed and hugged each other and ran away. So it seemed like maybe she had been dared to do this. So I got inspired by that, looking at the entire facade. There were 70 total windows, and I knew what I had to do. So this project is called Look Up More. We had 70 actors dressed in black. This was completely unauthorized. We didn't let the stores know we were coming. And I stood in the park giving signals. The first signal was for everybody to hold up these 4-foot-tall letters that spelled out Look Up More, the name of the project. The second signal was for everybody to do jumping jacks together. You'll see that start right here. And then we had dancing. We had everyone dance, and then we had dance solos where only one person would dance and everybody would point at him. So then I gave a new hand signal which signaled the next soloist down below in Forever 21, and he danced. There were several other activities. We had people jumping up and down, people dropping to the ground. And I was standing just anonymously in a sweatshirt, putting my hand on and off of a trash can to signal the advancement. And because it was in Union Square Park, right by a subway station, there were hundreds of people by the end who stopped and looked up and watched what we were doing. There's a better photo of it. So that particular event was inspired by a moment that I happened to stumble upon. The next project I want to show was given to me in an email from a stranger. A high school kid in Texas wrote me in 2006 and said, you should get as many people as possible to put on blue polo shirts and khaki pants and go into a Best Buy and stand around. So I wrote this high school kid back immediately and he said, yes, you are correct. I think I'll try to do that this weekend. Thank you. So here's the video. So again, this is 2005. This is the Best Buy in New York City. We had about 80 people show up to participate, entering one by one. We had, there was an 8-year-old girl, a 10-year-old girl. There was also a 65-year-old man who participated. So it was a very diverse group of people. And I told people, don't work. Don't actually do work, but also don't shop. Just stand around and don't face products. Now you can see the regular employees by the ones that have the yellow tags on their shirt. Everybody else is one of our actors. The lower level employees thought it was very funny, and in fact, several of them went to go get their camera from the break room and took photos with us. A lot of them made jokes about trying to get us to go to the back to get heavy television sets for customers. The managers and the security guards, on the other hand, did not find it particularly funny. You can see them in this footage. They're wearing either a yellow shirt or a black shirt. And we were there for probably about 10 minutes before the manager decided to dial 911. So they started running around telling everybody that the cops were coming. Watch out, the cops are coming. And you can see the cops in this footage right here. That's a cop wearing black right there being filmed with a hidden camera. Ultimately, the police had to inform Best Buy management that it was not, in fact, illegal to wear a blue polo shirt and khaki pants. Thank you. So we had been there for 20 minutes. We were happy to exit the store. One thing the managers were trying to do was to track down our cameras. And they caught a couple of my guys who had hidden cameras in duffel bags. But the one camera guy they never caught was the guy that went in just with a blank tape and went over to the Best Buy camera department and just put his tape in one of their cameras and pretended to shop. So I like that concept of using their own technology against them. I think our best projects are ones that are site-specific and happen at a particular place for a reason. And one morning, I was riding the subway. I had to make a transfer at the 53rd Street stop where there's these two giant escalators. And it's a very depressing place to be in the morning. It's very crowded. So I decided to try to stage something that could make it as happy as possible for one morning. So this was in the winter of 2009, 8:30 in the morning. It's morning rush hour. It's very cold outside. People are coming in from Queens, transferring from the E train to the 6 train, and they're going up these giant escalators on their way to their jobs. There's a photograph that illustrates it a little bit better. He gave 2,000 high fives that day, and he washed his hands before and afterward and did not get sick. And that was done also without permission, although no one seemed to care. So I'd say over the years, one of the most common criticisms I see of improv everywhere left anonymously in YouTube comments is, these people have too much time on their hands. And, you know, not everybody's going to like everything you do, and I certainly have developed a thick skin thanks to internet comments, but that one's always bothered me because we don't have too much time on our hands. The participants in Improv Everywhere events have just as much leisure time as any other New Yorkers. They just occasionally choose to spend it in an unusual way. You know, every Saturday and Sunday, hundreds...
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. I am Jessica, here with just a little indie for your listening pleasure this evening. And we're just going to get started right now with some newer music that we have here in the station. This is from the Dum Dum Girls, which was released back in September off the album Only in Dreams. Here you go on the station making waves, WHFR.fm.